Welcome to the Yeshiva Shalmaila. This week we're going to be speaking about one of the most interesting things in the headlines, the vaccine, and those who don't believe in it. What are they thinking? Additionally, those who don't believe in wearing masks. You know, sometimes you go into a store and nobody's wearing a mask and you wonder, do they have a death wish? Like, what are they thinking? So we have speakers on both sides of it. We have from England, Hagoyen Rav Akiva Tatz, the world famous. He's a physician. He's a medical ethicist, the Machabes Sfarim. A fabulous speaker. He's going to be speaking about the nemunis of doctors, the nemunis of the World Health Organization, of Dr. Fauci, Jewish and non-Jewish doctors, halachically, and to represent the side who does not believe in the vaccine against masks. We got Dr. Lawrence Palevsky. He's a physician. He's been speaking in Borough Park, Flatbush, Crown Heights, speaking about the dangers of the COVID vaccine and the lack of necessity to wear masks. And he has some very, you know, interesting theories that I guess a lot of our brethren in Borough Park, Flatbush, and Crown Heights buy into. He believes, for example, or we'll hear, that it's amazing that the COVID vaccine is so dangerous. There must be a sinister reason. And here's what he says.
But there seems to be a large involvement with efforts to take down the United States economy, take down the United States government, and to weaken us, to create a very different world economy.
And he also believes that a reason not to wear masks is because it's not transmitted person to person, but rather it was into the theory not to wear masks.
You think that it's being transmitted in the air. We're being told it's being transmitted in the air. You know, now you're supposedly finding it in the anuses of people. So is it something in the food? And if it is in the air, what is it that we're breathing in that's more than just a virus? Is it a poison? Is it a gas? Is it a parasite attached to the coronavirus due to gain-of-function research? Is it the effects of pulsations of electromagnetic radiation that can also create a problem with red blood cells not binding to oxygen?
So I know we have a lot of listeners who are Hasidim of Dr. Palevsky, and I'm sure they'd like to hear the give and take. When he speaks, you often can't ask him questions. We got to ask him some questions. And then for Bnei Brak, we have Reb Yaakov. He's one of those, you know, Bnei Brak has sort of become the epicenter of blowing up trucks and buses, etc., of the police, etc. So we're going to hear why exactly they're doing that and why don't they believe in the vaccine. Some of the people in Bnei Brak should be a very interesting program. Rabbeisai, what are your thoughts? 732-806-8700, press number 2. That's for what the Bnei HaYeshiva have to say. Or info@headlinesbook.com. We will post both messages, voicemails, as well as written, unless you request otherwise. But we're interested in what the Olam has to say. Here's a word from our sponsor. Around 3 weeks ago, we started DafHeadlines.com, and it's basically 5 minutes a day on the daf. Some of the really interesting halachas, like this week we did, if someone's on Atkins, does he need a wash on Shabbos? The carbs will take him out of ketosis. Can you put your fingers into the kaisel? What about selling on eBay or Amazon on Shabbos? Is a half mitzvah better than no mitzvah at all? All topics we take from the daf, and then we add on a minute or two of chizuk. So it's like, consider it 5 minutes of pure plasma in the morning. You could get it if you go to dafheadlines.com. You can sign up. You can get it by WhatsApp, by email, by messaging. And it's also for those who don't use the internet. We have phone lines as usual. We have 732-645-9500. In the UK, it's 443-301-170-397. And in Eretz Yisrael, it's a 72-258-7502. Now, here's something interesting. For many of you who have been listening over the years, I'm putting out Ezer Hashem, the third volume of Headlines in English, and I'll go through a lot of the topics, like 25 of the most interesting topics. Do we need to worry about insects now, fruits and vegetables? Do we need microscopes for it? A guns and shul, now that we had all those stories. Burial in Eretz Yisrael, how important is it? Giving maestas over to children, is that legal inheritance or is it nepotism? Owning pets. Racism. Do Black Lives Matter? Should yeshiva skip adult-oriented sugyas? Do we learn Pesach Pasuach in yeshiva or not? What about slavery? How does the Torah Rachel Darkenayim deal with slavery? Women in positions of leadership. All the topics. I have a lot of other topics too, but these are some of the more interesting ones. And we do them Alpi Torah with fabulous haskamas, etc. I think you'll enjoy it. Before we go, I want to like to say a vart on the parsha. This is a very special Shabbos, Shabbos Shira. Something special about it, since you're children, right? Since we're children. I want to ask you a question. Is your life a random series of events, or is there more of a narrative to it? So I think that's the story of Shabbos Shira. Shira is special. Kala Oimer Shira Ba'olam Hazeh Zaycha La'Imre La'Olam Haba. Why do we say it every day? Like, why are we singing Az Yashir Maisha on a daily basis? So let's go to the story. At the end of the Shira, Miriam comes out with drums. I don't know where she had drums from. And, you know, I don't know why she bought a set of drums through them, through the Kriyas Yamsa. You would think maybe other things came to mind. What does it say? She came out, Vatikach Miriam Hanaviyah, Taif Biyada, Shira Lashem. Like, why does the Shira end with Miriam? It's sort of like the punctuation, the underlying part. What is it? I want to put to you, there's a difference between Shira and Zimra. Shira, we say, Kol Bali Shir Yaitzim Bishir. A behemoth leaves with a shir. It's like a ring embedded in it. Shir means a ring. And there's two parts to a song. There's the part that flows, na da di da. So it has like a thing. And then it's dun, dun, dun. Shira is the circular part. And Zimra is where it's a march. You know, boom, boom. And they're different. And let me tell you how. The story of Mitzrayim starts, Vayelech ish mi beis levi, Vayikach es bas levi. He separated from her, and Miriam came and she said, your gzeira is worse than Pare's. And he takes back Vcheved, and a child is born, a beautiful child, Moshe. And the father looks at her and he says, the Gemara in Saita says, Biti nismale nevoasech. It was Niskaim, we had a son, a miracle. But then things really go down, go bad. She goes down to the water. She puts the beautiful baby by the suf. She's standing there. And the Gemara says her father patched her and he says, Hecha nevoasayach, what happened to your prophecy? But she had faith. Bas Pari saves the child. But Hecha nevoasayach. Fast forward 80 long years. A lot of pain, a lot of Jewish blood, a lot of Jewish tears later. And what happens? Almost a mirror image. The great Egyptian army with its Rechev of Prushim, the greatest army in the world, and they're trapped between them and the sea again. And then now there's again a Hisyatzvu. Same thing, all over again. Hisyatzvu Uru as Yeshua Hashem. Again, terror. What's going to happen to the child? And here it's all over again. Hisyatzvu, and again, Vayet Moshe es Yaday, stretched out the hand. And what happened? The water splits. So what happens? At the end of it, Moshe says Shira, Klal Yisrael says Shira. But remember, a Shira is different than Zimra. Zimra is like a dum, bum, bum. Something good happened. You got a raise. You got a deal. A baby. You bought a house. You found a great couch on eBay on sale. Something really good. That's Zimra. Shira is much more. Shira is when the circle closes. Everything comes together. It closes. You know when it really closes? When Miriam, who started it all, Vayikach ish mi bas levi, she said, have faith, and Hecha nevoasayach, 80 years later, she's standing there, Vatikach Miriam hanaviyah, toif biyada, Shiru Lashem gigayga, the circle has closed. It all makes sense. It was all layers of a symphony. It wasn't a series of random events. 1,000 years ago, a holy Jew came from Italy. His name was Reb Moshe ben Reb Kleinemus. By the way, those of you who sing, he was mechaber both Kol Mekadesh Shvi, Friday night, as well as Menucha V'Simcha. The same person did it. He lived in the year 950, long time ago. By the way, I personally sing Kol Mekadesh Shvi, and right afterwards I sing Menucha. So we sing them together. It's not by accident. They were mechaber by the same holy, almost before the Rishayim, Reb Moshe wrote, and he put into the davening that we should say Shira every day. And the question is why? I mean, Shira is really special. It happens once a year, Shabbos Shira, every day. But think of it this way. I asked, is your life a series of random events? Because if it is, sometimes something really painful happens. But if it's a narrative, suddenly we understand stories have the scary part so that we could be able to have the happy part. It's all part of the narrative. And when I say, is your life a series of random events? Most of the world, or a big part of the world, believes. that the entire universe is a series of random events. There was a random bang, series of incredibly mathematically almost impossible coincidences, and like living in a lucky casino, we're here today. But we don't believe that. Like the Ramban writes, yes, there was the Ramban writes this in Bereshit. There was a big bang. He writes it 1,000 years before science, so 800 years before science said it. And from them begat an incredible narrative. Soif ma'aseh b'machshava tchila. But what does it matter if it's a narrative? It means my life is really a symphony. Our lives are the symphony of the cosmos, everything moving in unison, coming to a story. And if we live like Miriam, the highs, the lows, and we see it as part of the symphony, we don't wince when the symphony has a deep note. We understand it's to create the high note. So I asked, what was Miriam doing with the Taif? Why did you come into the splitting of the Yamsuf carrying by, with a band? Because Miriam believed. In the beginning, she believed this is gonna end exactly like I thought. And therefore she brought the band along with her. So Rav Kleinema said, let's bring Shira into our everyday. Let's bring a band along with us in everything we do, because we, as Yidin, from a Yidin, Bali, we believe in Hashgacha, we believe in a symphony. Bring the band along with you. Say the Shira every day. And there are times it's really hard. Like things really go wrong. Chazal teach us that sometimes, even when it seems like totally out of the narrative, Hashem winks at me and you. And let me give you an example or two. Yosef is going down to Egypt. He was sold by his brothers. They dipped his sinus passim in blood, and they sell him as a slave. And they sell him to the Midyanim, and they're selling spices and incense. So Rashi says, wow, the tzaddik went down with spices, with Hashem put him into a wagon that was sent. And I ask you, he was being sold to slavery. Do you think a guy going away for life in Rikers really cares if the taxi smells of incense or not? But I put to you, it wasn't the incense. It wasn't that he enjoyed the ride down, but it was a wink from Hashem. You know what? It looks really bad. It's part of the narrative. And the simon that I'm with you is, something strange happened. Like, why is there incense here? It's a wink. It's part of a narrative. The Aruch HaShulchan says, we say in benching every day, HaTovah HaMetev, that the Harugei Beitar were given Lekfura. Every benching has to have it. It's the last bracha. Now, it was a really wonderful miracle that happened around 2,000 years ago, but do all of us have to extend our benching for the rest of our lives, like 2 times a day for as long as we live because something happened to the Harugei Beitar 2,000 years ago? But the Aruch HaShulchan explains it. He says, the Harugei Beitar were some 90 years after the Churban HaBayis that they were buried, and their bodies were fresh. They were ready for Kfura. He says it was like Hashem was winking. The Churban, it's not terminal. It's not over. It's part of the story. And the simon that is part of the story is that this miracle happened. So when we say the Shira every day, or when we bench and we say Harugei Beitar, it's reminding us Hashem often winks to us in the middle of tough times. And he's saying, Yingle, Yingle, it's all part of my child, it's all part of a narrative. And here's something the Briskerov said, astonishing word for honestly such a litvak. Usually, trauma is really serious. PTSD, there are, you know, whole psychologists, they make psychiatrists also, they're whole living out of PTSD, whatever traumas people go through. We say this every Shabbos, Shir Hamalais, another Shir, Yishuv Hashem, there will be a song at the end of time when everything comes together. That's a real Shir closing. Hayinu Kichalmim. So the Briskerov says, usually after a trauma, you need medical help. But if you have a bad dream and you wake up, you just look around, you shake it off, you don't need meds and you don't need a psychologist. He says, when at the end of time, Shir HaMalos, the song, the end, the last song, B'Shuv Hashem HaShiv HaSin, Hayinu Kichalmim, it'll come together so beautifully that it'll be like waking up from a dream. Everything will fit. There will be no trauma. So that's the message. And the question is, can we bring the Emunah of Miriam into our daily lives? Can we bring those drums, Taif and the Kina, along with us so that when we get those low moments, we say, wait, I'm going to say Shira. It's all part of my story. At the end, it's going to be Hayinu Kechelmim. Divrei Elokim Chayim. Here is the riddle of the week. Why does the Shira barely speak about the Hatzalah of Klal Yisrael? And it's almost all about the downfall of the Mitzrim. Omar Oyev Erdev Asi Gachal Temulema Nafshi Nashaf Tebruchacha Natisya Mincha Nechira. And then at the end it sticks in Ad Yavaram Hashem Ad Yavaram Zukanisa. Why isn't it more about our Hatzalah? Why is it so much about their downfall? That is our riddle of the week.
As always, if you'd like to send in a comment, 732-806-8700, and for comments, it's 2. Or you can email us, info@headlinesbook.com. We do put up the comments and the letters online, where readers or listeners can access them, unless you request otherwise.
Now let's go to our wonderful guests.
We have the honor of having us join from London, Rabbi Akiva Tatz, world-famous speaker. He's written over 8 Sfarim. He's an expert in Jewish medical ethics. He's a Magid Shir Be'er Sameach. He founded the Jerusalem Medical Ethics Forum. He's part of the Jerusalem Center for Research in Medicine and Halacha. Welcome, Rabbi Tatz.
Welcome, thanks. I'm not part of the second thing you said, but I am part of the first thing, but it's all good.
Okay, I took it off of Wikipedia, my bad. So what is the nemanis in halacha of a doctor? Like when people say, look, doctors say you have to wear a mask, or doctors say we should socially distance. So I'm going to ask 2 parts. What halachic significance do doctors pay halachically? And then what do you do when there's an achleikis? I mean, there are 25 million doctors in the world. I'm sure there's any number who believe the earth is flat. So what do we do when there is a machleikis among doctors? That's my 2 questions.
Okay, well, the first question is not really a hardcore halachic question. Anybody, an expert in a field, has a right to and is expected to know professionally about their field. I'm not sure we give them any particular halachic status. If there is halachic status, it probably relates to the Aruch HaShulchan, who says that doctors today need to be certified by some official body. Prior to his time, the requirements in many tshuvas were that doctors were ratified by the Beis Din of the town they worked in. There was no universal accreditation or examinations, and so Rabbonim and Poskim wanted to know that they were dealing with people who were genuine doctors, not just people who claimed that, and it was difficult to know which was which. Aruch HaShulchan, from his time, writes very clearly that nowadays we have national accreditation boards, certification boards, and so once a normal country has normal standards and they accredit doctors, that's good enough to give you the halachic status or the technical status of being a qualified expert in your field. And that's basically the standard that we use. The second question you ask is what happens when we have an argument between doctors, and of course doctors represent the whole social spectrum. The general approach that we've taken in halacha consistently throughout all the tshuvos is that when there's an argument among medical opinion, we look at a majority. So, you know, I remember a case where I was asked about a person who needed a complicated heart surgery. There was an argument among the doctors. And in fact, that was interesting because in that particular case, there was a majority of doctors who felt one operation should be done and a minority of doctors who felt a different one should be done, but the minority were more qualified. Interesting case. With one world expert.
Well, you have that in Yom Kippur. You have an Hilchos Yom Kippur. The Ran that the Mishnah Berurah brings says that you go after the Bucky. And in Hilchus in Bikkur Chaylim, Hilchus Bikkur Chaylim in Shin Lamed Vav, it also mentions a baki. Lo yisasek b'rafriu umbaki, v'lo yehesham gadol mimenu.
Yes, of course.
Whereas we need the biggest baki, and the Ran says that a baki, the Mishnah Berurah brings it, even one baki is better than 10 at Bikkiyim. In other words, we go after the expert.
Well, let me tell you what happened in this case. You see, Abdullah, I may disagree with you about one subtle point. We're talking about where they all Bikkiyim. You're talking about a situation where there's a baki and non-bakim. I'm talking about where they all, the people I'm talking about here, 2 of them were world-class cardiologists, and the second was a single cardiologist, but the 2 were world-level authorities. The single one was a world-famous authority who had taught the others. So they were all extreme bakim, but one was better than the other 2. So you had a majority of 2 against 1 who is more qualified. I asked the question to Rav Eliashiv. It was an emergency question. I was able to get hold of him within 20 minutes that day. And he said, in this case, the patient gets to choose. It's up to the patient to choose. The reason was, that both opinions, both sides of the question, were very reasonable medically. The only question was which package of risks and benefits did the patient want to live with, and Rutherford said it's up to him. So this, but the general answer to your question is when there's, and today in the COVID era, with so many crazy theories going around and so many people latching on to minority opinions, that's just not sensible. The way to handle it today is when you have a doctor or even a minority of doctors who may be numerous talking about one particular approach, we go with the majority, and that's the standard default position. Similarly with Peskin, you know, there may be one or two famous rabbis today who are not in favor of vaccines in general. We respect their opinion, but we don't follow that. You know, like anything in halacha, we have a vast majority in favor of general vaccines without getting into the specifics. We follow a majority in medicine. There's usually a standard default approach. Sometimes in medicine, there's more than one reasonable approach, and people are certainly free to choose that. But generally speaking, we look to the general established criteria that have been laid down. I may add, very importantly for your listeners, that a lot of this stuff about people sending, you know, historical videos and testimonials by doctors, you know, putting forward unproved therapies and stuff that they've had success with, it's a wrong hashkafa, Reb David. Hashkafa is Hashem expects you to do what is normal. That's the right hashkafa. Hashem does not require you to be a medical expert and a technological expert and an aviation expert and a metallurgical expert. He expects you to do what is called dashu beirabim, what the majority throng through in a certain area. Less than that is medically negligent. More than that is a lack of bitachon. It's a very important principle. How many locks do you need on your door? What is standard in your time and place? If people in your city have two locks on their door, one is negligent, and three is a lack of bitachon. And therefore, we have a dashu beirabim, shomei psoim Hashem. You're required to do what is standard and normal. It's a lack of bitachon to think otherwise. The treatment, the healing does not come from the little white tablet or from the surgery. It comes from Hashem. You need to make a shtadlus. And the basic shtadlus is broadly accepted consensus opinion. If there's minority opinions about something that's interesting, we should study them. And if there's evidence, we incorporate them in practice. That's a sensible, basic, calm, collected, hashkafic approach to the situation.
Okay, so what I hear from some of the people who are opposed, they say, they'll quote, let's say, the Shulchan Aruch says that if two Reishim say he doesn't need food, and he says, I do need food, he goes, Safik nefashis l'chumra. In this case, it would be lahakel because you're eating on Yom Kippur. But so they say, well, you may have thousands of doctors who say get vaccinated, but since there's a myth who say that when you get injected, you're getting all kinds of toxins in your body, Bill Gates will be able to track you wherever you go. It's a government tracking device. So we say safik lachumra, pikuach nefesh lachumra. Therefore, you listen to the minority doctors who believe you're being injected with all kinds of chemicals and computer chips, etc. How would you respond to that?
Now, David, I think you're trying to wind me up here, so I'm going to stay calm.
Rabbi, I kid you not. We have a rabbi like this saying this on the ear. I kid you not.
Okay, well, let me try to go through that in a cool, calm, collected fashion. First of all, the dimyon between Yom Kippur is not appropriate here. Here you're talking about a kula and a chumra. You're talking about eating Yom Kippur, which is pikuach nefesh, against the halacha, which in fact indeed agrees that if you need to eat, that's what you do because you need to be machmir on pikuach nefesh. And then there's another principle, lev yodas, ma'as nafshin, others, the heart of the patient knows whether he really needs it or not, and therefore we always on the side of saving life, and even if it's against a large number of doctors, if the patient is clear that it's a pikuach nefesh, we go in that direction. Now, when we apply that to the vaccines, we're talking about a vaccine which may have harms, but on the other hand, it may save your life. We're not talking about doing a vaccine for no reason that may have chips in it and microtechnology and who knows what it's going to do to you. That's not the correct balance. The correct balance is if you're talking about somebody highly vulnerable to COVID and people are dying around us. Unfortunately, my own brother-in-law died of COVID last week. No,
oh,
so
I know.
My sister's husband, yeah, so he's a youngish man, you know. And so we're talking about a life that if a person's vulnerable and there's a serious risk of their dying of COVID and we're giving a vaccine for which we don't have evidence yet of harm, then that is the calculus we made. Indeed, when we're dealing with younger people, I'm not in favor of the vaccine. If you're dealing with teenagers and children today, talking about a new vaccine, we don't yet know the harms and complications down the road. We know that every medical treatment has risks and harms. There's no question about that. In this case, we're not aware what they are yet, but I have no doubt certain side effects will turn up in time. And therefore, I don't think it makes sense to give to people who are not vulnerable. Once we've gone down a few months or maybe longer and we've seen dashu beirabim and we see good evidence coming in, we may think differently. If we need herd immunity, that might be different as well. But at the present time, we'll be dealing with new vaccines. Each of them has a new angle to it, some are new technology, and some on you from other points of view. My personal feeling, and I wouldn't be stubborn about this, and I'm not a virologist, I happen to be a regular doctor, but my approach to this is young people where there's very low risk of COVID at the moment, and again, that may change with variants coming through. I don't think that most people should be vaccinated at present, but if you're dealing with high-risk people, extremely vulnerable, we're facing a definite threat to their lives, and a vaccine which at the present appears to be safe, I think the calculus is that it makes sense to vaccinate at present the vulnerable people. That's my personal take on it at the moment.
And what about the middle? So you said the teens you wouldn't, the vulnerable, yes. What about from 20 to, I don't know, pick the other side of that number? What would you do there?
Of course, that's a very good question, and I'm afraid to have to tell you this is a question of judgment and personal choice. For example, the American professional guidelines with respect to vaccinating pregnant women at the moment is another group that is not clear. The honest answer is we just don't know. We just do not know yet what are the risks exactly to the pregnant women. We don't know what the risks of the vaccine are yet. It's very hard to make that calculation. We cannot pretend that we have knowledge that we don't have. This is very new. COVID is still posing risks and unusual features. And the professional OBGYN guidelines that were issued recently, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, this is not entirely clear. It's a risk-benefit assessment we don't know exactly how to make. We urge women to be guided by their personal doctors and make personal choices. I'm afraid we just don't have better information than that at present. I would add one small detail, and I think halakhically this is correct, is that if you're not 100% sure whether an action will help or harm, we choose Shebaal Taiseh. So if I don't know, as a doctor, my medical instinct always is to hold back and not do whenever I can get away with that. And if you're talking about those in the intermediate zone, I don't yet know what the risk is of the vaccine. I don't yet know how vulnerable they are to the disease. I personally, in those situations, would hold back and not give the vaccine at the moment. But where that red line cutoff is very difficult to assess. I may add, when it comes to lockdowns, it's also very difficult for governments to assess, the balance between locking down people, which prevents the spread of infection, and the terrible damage you do to society when you lock people down as well. It's also a life and death question. That's a very, very difficult one to call. And I think there's room here for people to learn how to cooperate. You mentioned masks and so on. There's evidence on both sides of the equation. The preponderance of expert opinion is that it probably helps. And I think we need to learn how to cooperate rather than be divisive where we can.
Let me go back to one point there. The Shulchan Aruch in Shin Chav Ches, right, in Refuah. So let me quote a line. Kol choyli sherefin oimrim shu sakana, mechal anavas ha-shabbos, vim reifei echad amir tzarech, reifei echad amir enei tzarech, mechal an, you always go l'chumra. So what this rabbi would ask me, he said, look, the vaccines may be dangerous. And they believe they are dangerous. The anti-vaxxers believe all vaccines are dangerous. The Refuah that it's causing is unknown. We don't know that the guy is going to get sick. So when the doctor tells you not to vaccinate, even when it's a vulnerable person, you should listen to that doctor because he's saying, l'chumra, maybe you could kill the guy by vaccinating
him. But again, Robert, as I tried to explain, if you're dealing with a highly vulnerable person in a wildly spreading epidemic, talking about somebody where there's a sakana in front of you now, this is what the lawyers call a real and present danger. This is a person who's at high risk at the moment, especially with new variants, and he's exposed to those. We're not talking about a neutral situation. We're talking about a person whose life we are anxious
to save. Yeah, but they believe the vaccines are equally dangerous.
But I think that's complete. That is medically and scientifically unfounded. The response to people like that has to be, bring me the evidence. Let me mention at this point, if I may, I gave a long talk on this, and if people go to akivatats.com, there's a talk there called Viruses, Vaccines, and the Lone Ranger. The Lone Ranger being that single opinion against the establishment who in the movies always turns out to be right. The answer to give to people like that is, let's see the evidence. If there's hard evidence, we go with the evidence. And how you assess evidence has clear scientific rules and medical rules. If there's no evidence, it's just the fear that there may be complications down the line. That's a different question.
So they, what they respond is, and I have to deal with these people. That's why I ask it to you. What they would respond is, I know 17 people who took the vaccine and had terrible after effects and this and that. They called me for ATIS. So I'm telling you the vaccine is dangerous.
So how do you respond to that? That's important to know how to deal with that. Let's deal with that. The first important thing to know is that we accept that there may be dangers. In other words, as the Ramban says, what heals one kills another. Nobody claims that any medical intervention is totally safe. That's absolutely for sure. For example, with the first million doses of the COVID vaccine, 9 people had very serious anaphylactic reactions. That's about 10 times as much as we get with a flu vaccine, but it's still only 9 people out of a million. And 7 of the 9 were people who had severe allergic reactions in the past and were carrying EpiPens. All 9 survived, although they needed treatment. So we know that that's a very low rate of severe acute reactions at the moment. But nobody claims that any medical modality is safe. Absolutely not. And that's part of the rapa yirapa that the Torah mandates. So we accept that there will be dangers in the vaccines, and at this point they're unknown. We know we are giving dangers. The calculation we make is the danger of the vaccine or any medical intervention likely to be less than the danger of the disease? Let me give you a dramatic example. I asked Rav Zilberstein recently the following question. There's a viral epidemic going on in Malaysia and certain parts of South America. It's called dengue fever. Not our problem in our parts of the world, but it's a serious illness that kills a number of children. And the problem is they've developed a vaccine which kills a certain number of children. No question about it. We know that there's a certain rate of death due to the vaccine. But it's one-tenth the rate of children who die from the disease. Okay, so here we're dealing with a million children, and a certain number of thousands of children are going to die from the disease. If you give them the vaccine, you'll prevent those deaths, but you'll cause a smaller number of deaths. And of course, there's a very strong emotional reaction there. You mean you want me to give a vaccine in which I will be guilty of taking my own child's life? And Rav Zilberstein Pluskin, they need to give the vaccine. Why? Because what you're doing is you're exchanging one danger for a tenth of the danger, which you can do. It's true that when you do it, you'll be causing that small number of deaths. It's true. You'll be doing that due to your vaccine. But the price that's the price you're paying to save 10 times as many children.
And I have it's a price. Raya. I have a Raya.
Yeah.
A Raya from the Gemara in Shuas, right? Islam and Zion, I don't have the Gemara in front of me. The Gemara says a king is allowed to order, allowed to take people to his people to war.
Where he feels necessary. Yes,
for the benefit of the kingdom, kill up to a sixth. And what's the logic?
Yeah.
Because a government has to make decisions that are for the benefit of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a right to do it, I think, Achisa, until six, up to a sixth will die, or a fifth, a very large amount. Whereas he's saying, look, there's no doubt that this will cause some death, but it will overwhelming benefit to it. So halachically, you're allowed to do that.
Yes. Well, the Gemara you're quoting actually is a Gemara about a king sending his people into war.
Yeah,
in a non-Jewish situation. Actually, Rav Zilberstein asked Rav Yosef that question a number of years ago when he was alive. Is it acceptable to take things that have a risk of 1 in 6 when you need to do them? He was asking about a person who wanted to do a parnasa activity and it would have about a 1 in 6 risk of dying. Quoting that Gemara. And there were poskim who quoted that. Yashiv said that is much too high, David. He said one in six is much too high.
But respectfully, I think the Gemara is poskiming it about a governmental authority.
Correct.
Looking out for the greater good. Yeah. Whether a person himself, I mean, the Gemara says, Lagabe Parnasa, Ayla Besulam, Ayla Bekeveth. So it does talk about accepting danger, but the number of 1 in 6 is talking about societally.
Yes, correct, indeed. That's what he said. So where the numbers are is a question for diaspora. But so I think that let's do the second point because it's fundamental for people to understand this. I know 7 people who died after getting the vaccine. Though it is extremely important for your listeners to understand that correlation is not causation. Let me say that again. Correlation is not causation. Let me make this clear as I can. Here's a lady whose husband happened to be a doctor, and he died the day after getting some vaccine. I'm not sure what vaccine it was. She's now on an international campaign to stop that vaccine being given. What she doesn't realize is that many people will die the day after getting a vaccine, because many people are dying every day anyway. Children who get autism, for example, they say, my child got autism, and 3 weeks before they had the measles vaccine. Every child who gets autism had a measles vaccine before because every child is being vaccinated.
And more than that, and I would add on to what you're saying, the age of autism correlates almost exactly to the times when we start giving the second series of vaccines, when autism is noticed.
Of course.
What people need
to understand is that if you want to link somebody with a causative connection, you need to take 100,000 people who got the vaccine and then died the next day, and 100,000 people who didn't and did not. You need to show a difference between a control group and an experimental group, and the fact that some people complained about certain things that happened and happened to get the vaccine. You need to show a causative connection. Now, if you have an instinct or a hunch that this may be connected, by all means, let's do a study. And if you find there's a link between them, that's very important. But just to make an assumption that because two things are associated in time does not mean there's a causal connection between the two. People need a little sophistication in how to read evidence and how to assess evidence. And my personal opinion is if you're not a professional in this area, you don't really have a right to an opinion. You know, just making wild connections, not knowing how to, I'll give you another example. When scientific studies are done, we use a p-value. The p-value is about 1 in 20. That's usually, 0.05 is usually the thing that's accepted. That means that in any scientific study, there's a 1 in 20 chance that your result will be by chance, completely by chance. You need to know that. And therefore, any medical result, whether it's safety or danger, you need to know for every study that was done. I want to see 20 studies are done. I want to say that 19 out of 20 show the same result, not 1 out of 20. You need a little sophistication in knowing how to read the evidence and interpret the evidence correctly.
Okay. So when somebody's vulnerable, or even not vulnerable, they're in their 30s. I mean, I know people in their 30s who died, right?
Yeah.
He wants to get the vaccine. Does he ask a doctor or does he ask his rav?
That's a great question. The first address is medical. Rabbis have no business giving rulings on medical issues. They don't rule on you know, mining or on aviation or anything else. They consult expert opinion. A rabbi has no business getting involved in the technicalities of epidemiology or virology. However, when there's a medical halakhic question, which is balancing of risks, how does the halakha look at that? In that case, certainly the rabbi should be the one helping the patient make the decision. Now, when a person is 30 years old and they're considering the risks and benefits of the vaccine, the first thing is to get medical opinion. And today, medical opinion will be split in that particular age range. That may be a difficult question. But again, the person ought to get the best medical opinion available. And if that raises a halachic question, why not talk it over with the rabbi, who's supposed to be a person of Da'as Torah and good judgment as well? Absolutely, why not?
Okay. Now, if that
results in a split decision or difficult to call, I think the Sheikh Baal Tarsia is probably the right decision. That would be my personal approach in this particular thing. That may change with time as more information of the vaccine is coming.
By the way, I want to quote, I've said it before on the air, but in Igris Rebbe Kivega, Michtav Ayin Gimel, he says, His harti panim harbe, hazhara achar hazhara, it should be asher, kefi asher shaftu haroifim li zarabizah, v'lo yavru al devreim kimloi nima.
Yeah.
Rebbe Kivega. Okay, is there any difference between a Jewish and a non-Jewish doctor?
I don't think so. I think sometimes there's an important difference. The halachic issue is at stake, and that needs to be understood. In other words, why are you giving a medical opinion here? Hilchas Neder, for example, things where the consequences need to be known. And sometimes it's a pure medical opinion, factual and professional due to expertise, and I don't think it makes any difference at that point whether the person's Jewish or not. Why? Why should it?
Well, because halachically we see many places where a guy doesn't have nemanis.
I think one needs to use one's judgment about whether that's true or not. We see many places in halacha where a non-Jew has nemanis. And therefore, the question of, again, halacha needs to be clarified in that particular situation. If the person has nemanis, and I hate to tell you this, there's many Jews who don't either, you know, but in that situation where there's no evidence or halachic reason to withhold, in that case, we get the best expert opinion we can.
Okay. How do you deal with, as a physician, when people, and I get, you know, you're believing the doctors, Toiv Sheberaisim Ligahenim. How do you deal with that?
Well, that's got nothing to do with Nehemonis. I mean, thanks for reminding me about that, David, that I can look forward to sharing Gehenim. I appreciate that. But
I'll tell you, by the way, just for the record, Rav Shach's doctor asked him the question.
Yeah.
he was very yippee Gavin. So Rav Shach looked at him and he said, In Gehenim vet medarfin gutter reifim. but you wouldn't believe how this is used in debate. Like, what do you mean you're believing the doctors, the WHO, the world? They're all type Chevrolet from Gehenim. How do you respond to that?
Well, again, the concept of Gehenim for doctors has nothing to do with their nemonis. Okay, it may do with their pride, the fact that they take sometimes excessive responsibility and don't ask others. There are different shatim in what that means, but it's got zero to do with nemanis of a majority of doctors or qualified doctors in any given situation. Of course, doctors are fallible and vulnerable, we know that. But again, the concept here is Dashu Beirabim, where there's a consensus of medical opinion or a highly qualified physician with a good track record, then one takes opinion seriously. Again, it's not a religious, fundamental tenet of one's hashkafa, but dealing with an expert, and if the expert is qualified and what he's talking about is in line with his experience and expertise and evidence, then that is a weighty factor to bring into play in these decisions.
Okay, another question. Do we have a communal obligation to vaccinate to create herd immunity? And why do I say that? Because that 25-year-old who is likely going to, when he gets it, will get it, will likely be asymptomatic, or that 17-year-old, but he is going to infect somebody else who's going to infect the grandfather and the elder person who will die from it. So is there a halachic communal obligation to create herd immunity, sort of like Samay Dal Dam Reyecha could be, it could be called Yisrael La'Revim Zelaze, etc.?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Unfortunately, that one's easy to answer at present with respect to COVID, and that the answer is no. In other words, to make this clear, let's take a circumstance where the answer is yes. For example, the polio vaccine or a measles vaccine. There, the community is protected entirely because we're generating herd immunity. The best example I can give you is German measles. In German measles, believe it or not, we give the vaccine to boys. Now, German measles does not threaten anybody unless they're pregnant. The problem with German measles is absolutely one thing only, and that is the fetus. If the mother, while she's pregnant, gets it at a certain stage of pregnancy, the fetus can be very seriously affected. But the threat to the mother or young girls or boys is absolutely virtually zero. It's a very mild illness. But we give it to everybody. Why are we giving a vaccine for German measles to boys? They ain't going to be pregnant. The answer is, we need herd immunity that the disease does not spread in the general community so that those individuals who did not respond to the vaccine or were not vaccinated don't get it. Is that moral? Absolutely. Is it totally accepted? Absolutely. Is it halakhically valid? No question about it. However, and that applies to measles, by the way, which is a very high infectivity. It applies to polio.
Rubella. I mean, rubella is very dangerous to the fetus.
That's the German measles I was talking about, indeed. It applies during the days of smallpox, and of course, there's no question about it. COVID at the present, we're not looking at it like that yet. In other words, even the most stringent national guidelines around the world are not talking yet about herd immunity. In fact, the professional guidelines in most places at the moment are to vaccinate the vulnerable, certainly first, and later we'll talk about the young people. And therefore, the answer to your question is nobody, not even in the professional field, not even in the secular field, is aiming at the present time for general herd, at least not at this stage of the epidemic.
Well, in Israel they are.
Okay.
But Rabbi Katz, I want to ask you the following question. I want to point it out. The reason they aren't is not because it's not necessary, but because there's just a shortage of the vaccine.
Okay, so it gives us a little breathing space before we need to continue your question. If we get to a point where it becomes a question of herd immunity being necessary, and that will save lives, this will become a real question. How we will operate in that environment, I'm not sure.
Why?
I tell you why, because I would like to reserve judgment until I have more evidence about the vaccine. I'm a very cautious and conservative person, and as a doctor, I have an instinct that leads me to try to hold off on things like vaccines where possible, and therefore I'm not dealing directly with a vulnerable level of society, and by that I mean not only the vulnerable, I also mean the people who work with them. I have a friend who's a physician in New Jersey, he's a young man, he told me he's getting vaccinated. He can't bear the thought of infecting a vulnerable patient of his, and therefore he's taking the vaccine as well, and I think that's correct. So at the present time, I would like to hold off as long as possible. Once we have some months down the line and better evidence for safety of vaccines, I may think about it. And if we're talking about a variance in the COVID thing, which are becoming very lethal, and we're talking about a much more serious threat in different ages as well, then we could, and herd immunity becomes an essential way to deal with it. Perhaps we need to consider that at that time. I'm going to hold judgment about that for the moment. And the reason is when you're dealing with measles or polio, you're dealing with a vaccine that we know very well. There's no question it is already a Dashubei Rabin. Rabin Yashiv told me that himself. He told me that personally. He looked me in the eye and he said, you need to vaccinate this particular child. It was a question of about a family that didn't want the vaccine. Not because it's safe, but because it's normal. And therefore, when we're dealing with a vaccine that has become normal, don't ask me how many months or years have to go by before it becomes normal. But once it's a Dashubei Rabin, that it's a normal thing that's done in society, it becomes an obligation. We're not quite there yet with the new COVID vaccines.
Discuss the new strain.
I mean,
I think it's particularly poignant here because I believe you are from South Africa. So let's talk about the South African strain that they believe they're uncertain. They say it may not be covered by the vaccine. Just now we're going as a medical expert. How concerned should we as a society be? Does this mean this is just, it's not over, but it's just beginning and we're just going to see wave after wave of new diseases, et cetera?
Well, again, I'm not an expert enough to tell you the fine details. I'm not a virologist or epidemiologist. By the way, it's not only South African. There's a Brazilian version. There's a UK version as well. It certainly is concerning because it means the virus is mutating enough to give us concerning new strains. And some of the issues are, will it be more virulent? Will it attack younger people? Will our vaccines be effective against it? We absolutely do not know yet. And it looks very concerning. And I think the main response we should have is turn more strongly to Hashem, because he's obviously giving us a message here that he's not through with us yet with this epidemic. He obviously wants a better response from us. But the technical way this thing will play itself out is not clear yet. Unfortunately, there's still a lot of unknowns with COVID, including new variants. We do not yet know. We don't have a good model for this in the past. We know it's a new danger and something to concern us. We don't yet know beyond that at the moment.
Okay. Is there any question that I missed that I should have asked you?
An interesting question at this point is, why are we dealing with so many extreme conspiracy theories and theories? A very interesting thing. Rabbi Zimmerman, who's a senior Persic in London, he said COVID has led to the loss of three things: smell, taste, and common sense. And I think he's correct. Very interesting question why people are becoming hysterical about outlandish theories. And I think we could speculate about why that is. But the message I'd like to say about those things is that when anybody gives you a theory about anything, nanotechnology and vaccines or whatever it is, almost always there's some truth in it, some basis, always. Interesting to note that. And secondly, I think it's a good thing that people are prepared to go against the establishment. To have people lie down and take it, like in totalitarian societies where people are unable to object, I think it's a healthy thing that people are prepared to go against the establishment. But, I say, there's one criteria that needs to be applied, and that is evidence. You have a theory, bring me the evidence. You make an assertion that they're putting nano chips in the virus, in the vaccine. Okay, is it possible? Maybe. Give me the evidence, just to make assertions. And it's the whole, David, I'm getting people now who are haranguing me with theories that are self-contradictory. I've got people who've been haranguing me for I don't know how long about the fact that drugs are bad. You need only alternative medicine because drugs are made by companies and they're only making money. The same people now telling me why hydroxychloroquine needs to be used. Hey, buddy, that's a drug made by a drug company. You, last month, you were against any drugs because they're all made by a big pharma that is making money out of you. Now you, why is this happening? Because chloroquine is being victimized by the majority. It's a certain vocal minority that think that it's being hidden for political reasons, yet it's effective, even though many studies have attempted to validate it. That's just unbalanced. And therefore, this mentality of being the lone ranger against the majority and always turning out to be right, people need to see sometimes the lone ranger is right and he's heroic and a wonderful personality, and sometimes very often the lone ranger is wrong. And therefore, the answer is evidence. You have a single theory against the establishment. That's very brave. That's very interesting. Let's examine it. Let's do a study that meets the criteria of scientific validation. And if it turns out to be valid, that's wonderful. If it turns out to be wrong, then you need to admit it.
Okay, one last question. I got this from an attorney, Sheldon Chanelis, who I know well, and he lives in like the Teaneck area. He said Teaneck has been very vigilant about it, and they've had very few deaths. It's been really well contained. And he says, and he hears like in Williamsburg, there've been hundreds of deaths. In Lakewood, there've been 100 deaths. In Borough Park, 100,000 deaths, right? And he just wrote me an email. He said, do these people have a death wish? Like, what is it? I just don't understand it. Isn't self-preservation the first human value? He says, explain to me the logic of these people. Chassan is for 10,000 people. There was a Chassan in Borough Park last week for 2,000 people. He said, do they have a death wish? Could you explain that?
I can't explain it, David. I think it's highly irresponsible. I think it puts us in a very bad light as well. And I think the phenomenon needs probably a number of themes that will lie behind it. It's an uneducated approach. It's people who don't take the secular view and professional opinion seriously for various historical reasons and emotional reasons. It's a long subject to speculate about. But the bottom line is, this is an opportunity to learn how to cooperate and take the safe view. And I think it's very sad that we have people in the community who don't understand the seriousness of this. And we need to do what we can to be sensible, present evidence, and try to stand together where it is sensible.
Rabbi Tat, it's an honor to have you on with us. Thank you so much. And continue Harbatzos Torah.
Amen. Thank you very much, and all the best.
Kolta, bye-bye. Joining us from New York City is Dr. Lawrence Paletsky. He's from the Northport Wellness Center. And he has been giving a number of presentations, I guess, opposed to taking the COVID vaccine. Welcome, Dr. Paletsky.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay. So, Dr. Paletsky, given the fact that this pandemic is sweeping the world and that many people are dying from it, I have two neighbors who died from it. My wife has two elderly aunts who died from it. We have a husband and wife right here in the neighborhood, both died of it. Do you believe that? Let's start with elderly people, let's say over the age of 65, or maybe people who have other health issues. Do you believe they should be getting the vaccine?
Well, I want to take a step back and discuss the issue of whether or not this is a vaccine in the first place.
Okay.
There's an automatic acceptance that what we're getting is a vaccine. And if we look at the definition of a vaccine is supposed to prevent the illness from occurring. It's supposed to prevent death, and it's supposed to prevent the transmission of the virus. And no study has shown any of that to be true up to this point. In fact, the experts who had been involved in the research and the experts who are talking about this injection have said, we did not test it to see if it would stop the transmission of the germ. So right now we don't know. We did not test it to see if it would prevent death. So far we don't know. And we have shown that it's not going to stop you from getting the illness.
Okay, so Dr. Paletsky, it's interesting. You know, this is rapidly developing. We understand that vaccines usually take 5 years to be put together, tested. But it's like the right way to do surgery is with extensive prep. But if somebody's brought into the operating room with gunshot wounds, they triage. A lot of times they're cutting corners. I don't think anybody would deny that this vaccine, they cut corners because of the fact that it basically stopped the world. But here's an interesting piece of data. Today, this is today's Jerusalem Post. 0.02 out of every 10,000 Israelis who got two shots of the Pfizer vaccine caught COVID-19. That's one out of 2,000 people. The Maccabi Health Fund released preliminary results in a study comparing vaccinated and not vaccinated members likability to contract disease. They said it's 0.04, which is 4 out of 10,000. A total of 371 out of 715, three quarters of a million Israelis, basically, who passed a week after receiving two doses of the virus have contracted the virus, with just 16 out of the 750,000 being sent to the hospital. So it's true that there is no data, and data is coming in as we speak, but I thought this was a really good, positive piece of data.
Okay, so now that you're using that information as expert information, which...
I'm not using it as expert. I'm using it as Israel,
Netanyahu said...
I'm not an expert, and I don't know that the Maccabi. We're using it as data, just simple, like a data scientist would use data. Israel's going to be sort of the bubble for data coming out, and if Maccabi is correct, which there's no reason not to, it's a very acclaimed science center in Israel, medical center. I would think it's an extremely hopeful piece of data, wouldn't you say?
No, not at all.
Okay.
There's a lot of information that's still unavailable.
Okay.
From that article.
Okay.
So you, as many in the world are apt to do, you read that and you all of a sudden think it's an interesting piece of information.
Right.
But what does it mean to catch COVID? How does it make that diagnosis?
Okay.
Is it just from a swab to catch it, or is it actual development of symptoms?
Okay.
So you can't make any assessment of what that information means until you know what the definition of catching COVID is. Because if you're just relying on a nasal swab as a PCR test and not relating it to whether or not the person has symptoms, then the information is irrelevant.
Well, the nasal swabs are accurate. They're not 100% accurate, but they're between 85 and 95% accurate, no?
I think we have a very different understanding of what's true.
Okay.
Because you are saying to me, as an expert, that the nasal swabs are 85 to 90% accurate. You took that information from the experts and you accepted it. I took that information from the experts and I did my research and I found out that there could be up to 90% false positives in those nasal swabs, all depending on the number of cycle thresholds that are used to measure whether the test is positive or not. So you're an expert because you accepted the expertise from the experts. And I don't agree with you, and I don't abide by it, because the PCR tests are inaccurate, they are faulty, and there's a lot of problems with the results.
Okay, but it does say only 16 out of 750,000 people had to be sent to the hospital. So regardless of the nasal swabs, I would think that's a really positive piece of information.
Again, I don't have enough information to say yay or nay.
Okay.
Because I don't know what the symptoms were. I don't know what other treatments they were getting. I don't know what tests were done. And so if they were just relying on nasal swabs, then we're not talking about the same thing here.
Okay, so doctor, let me ask you a question. If in Israel they're trying to get everybody vaccinated by Passover, I mean, literally the entire population of 7 or 8 million people, at least not the children, but any adult, if they do it, and the vaccine stops the disease in Israel, would you be convinced, and should the world be convinced, that in effect they have found an effective vaccine to stop the virus?
Well, have you proven that the vaccine is what stopped the disease?
And what could have stopped it besides the vaccine?
Oh, so you're saying that there's nothing else in existence right now that we have information about that could either stop the disease or cure it?
No, it's possible that they give the 7 or 8 million people the country by Passover, and it becomes the only country in the world that does not have this disease. No, I'm asking, and it's possible that it's a coincidence. I don't disagree. It's possible that 7 or 8 million people got it. Israel is now COVID-free if they close the borders, but it is possible mathematically that it is a coincidence. That's true. What else could it be? If there's no more COVID in Israel, what could it be?
I'm not going to get into that because there's a lot more here to discuss.
Yeah.
And if you're just talking about a nasal swab as a positive case, you're already talking faulty information.
But let's say you do the PCP, the best swab in the world, and come after Passover.
There is no swab.
Okay, so we don't do testing. But after Israel, nobody gets sick, nobody gets sent to the hospital, nobody dies. Would you take that as evidence that it works?
No, because I don't know what it is that people are really getting sick from.
Okay.
And there are many of us in the world who are wondering what is really making people sick.
Okay.
And that's a separate, several-hour conversation that we can have.
Okay.
Because it doesn't fit the way a virus infects the body.
Okay.
And so you and many others, most people in the world, have accepted that the only thing that could be making people sick from these symptoms is a virus.
Right.
And I'm very confident in the science that exists that should be a good question as to whether or not it's a virus that's making people sick.
Do you believe, doctor, that there's some type of a conspiracy here to keep the medical knowledge, the after effects of this, to squash it?
I believe that there's a problem in the way in which correct information is being made available to the public.
Okay. So there's a worldwide epidemic. It's closed, shopping, offices. I mean, in New York City, 10% of offices are occupied. Millions of people have lost their jobs. Anybody in the restaurant business and the hotel business, I mean, the unemployment in New York City is 20%. Death is everywhere. Medicine has used its best efforts, not perfect, but its best efforts to create a product to allow us to go back to normal. Right? Every pharmaceutical company worth its salt has been rushing and being paid by the government to come up with a solution. So they're certainly incentivized from a profit point of view. So is it the perfect solution? I doubt it. I mean, like you said, it could take 10 years to create a good vaccine or 20 years, whatever. But they've done the best they could. So the question is, should we accept the best they could, or should we just sit for another year with masses of people dying, with all the businesses closed, with the fallout, incredible fallout to society? Like, what do you suggest as a solution?
Well, number one, you're very certain about what's really going on here, and I don't know that there's any room for you to see that there's something else going on here. That's number one. Number two, there are many of us who've suggested solutions, and it has 100% been censored and removed from any public debate. So if you really want to know what needs to be done here, the information that hundreds of thousands of doctors have and hundreds of thousands of scientists have about the faulty PCR test and that the serious nature of this illness and the unbelievable amount of treatments that medical doctors have been using to save people from this illness, let's have that debate in public and not have it censored in the news. You have a system worldwide that is telling you that a positive case is based on a PCR test that has never been proven to be valid. You have people who are investigating the PCR test and finding material on there that may actually contribute to the onset of this disease after people have the nasal swab put inside their nose. You have people who are getting medications, supplements, and medical interventions who are surviving within 24 to 48 hours from the onset of symptoms. You have a disease condition that is not classic for a viral illness, that is being censored. Medical doctors who have described the illness as something different from a viral illness have been censored, they have been fired, and they have been removed from any ability to talk about this in public. So yes, I agree. There is something very nefarious going on with the lack of the ability to not only discuss this in public, release other information, and to talk about the fact that there's an effort to shove through an injection that has never been proven to be effective as a vaccine, that has never been utilized ever before in the history of injections to implement a vaccine program, and that has the potential to create death, shock, neurological conditions, infertility, abortions, loss of the miscarriages, and autoimmunity, and the potential for significant lung and kidney damage, all of which has been found in people who have gotten an injection and animals that have also been studied with this kind of technology. And you are not, as a public, being able to hear any of that information. And instead, you are all certain that what the authorities are telling you is 100% true. And what you're also not telling your public is that all the experts are saying to you, even if you get this injection, society won't go back to normal. You're still going to have to wear your mask. You're still going to have to isolate. And you're still going to have to be in lockdown. So if you think this is a magic bullet that's going to make life go back to normal, think again.
So, doctor, what science tried its best. This is what they came up with. What would you do? Let's say you say, I reject the vaccine. Should we just allow the world to continue to be shut down? What's your suggestion?
Well, again, that's a good question, because there's plenty of evidence to show that a lockdown is not and was never necessary, because there are other strategies by which this could have been addressed, as it has been done in the past.
So what is that? Tell us. What should we do?
Well,
you have the microphone. What should we do?
Anybody, we should go back to normal life.
And with just people dying all over the place? Super spreader events? Like, everybody should go back to the office?
Here's the interesting thing. No study anywhere in the medical literature has shown that people who are asymptomatic are the ones responsible for causing an outbreak. And so we have changed the definition of medicine just to fit this narrative that people who have symptoms are dangerous. And people who don't have symptoms are also dangerous. That has never been shown to be scientifically true, but we're changing that definition.
So what do you suggest, doctor? If you were the chief medical officer of the United States, what would you say?
Oh, if I were the chief medical officer of the United States, a lot of things would be different.
So,
but we'd be having a very different conversation in public.
But what would you do? I want to go back to the office. What should I do?
What we would do.
Yeah.
Here's what we would be doing. We would be talking about the fact that Dr. Anthony Fauci spent millions of dollars of United States tax money to do special research on coronavirus to make it potent, virulent, and potentially fatal if people were exposed to them.
Right.
Now, why was Dr. Fauci doing research called gain-of-function research on coronavirus?
Right.
And then why do we have a coronavirus epidemic? Why was he doing gain-of-function research, David? Why do we all of a sudden have a coronavirus outbreak, knowing full well that coronaviruses are not fatal? The infections are not fatal. But why is it...
So why are people dying?
Well, hold on. I don't know, because there are hundreds of thousands of people who died of underlying conditions that were labeled as dying from COVID, even though they did not have the symptoms of COVID. And so those numbers, and even the CDC, David, has admitted that they have augmented the numbers of people who died from COVID because they changed the diagnosis. They told hospitals, they told nursing homes to make sure that the diagnosis of COVID was on the death certificate, even for people who died of cancer, who died of a motorcycle accident, who died of a heart attack.
Yeah, but doctor, in a nursing home, that I know nursing homes, I have friends, they own nursing homes, the coronavirus came in, 47 people died in the next week. This isn't motorcycle accidents. These are people I know, right?
What you're quoting is governors around the United States.
Not governors. These are the owners. Guy tells me, he says he had a nursing home. It's 180 beds.
I'm almost finished with my sentence.
Yeah, yeah.
That there are governors around the country that sent sick people with COVID symptoms into nursing homes.
Right.
That created the increased death in nursing homes.
But it's not infectious. So what would you do? If you're the chief medical officer of the United States, what would you do?
We'd be having a very different discussion.
But what would you do? But after the discussion, what would you do? Would you open up? Should we just go back to life? What would you do?
Well, we have to start realizing that this illness was a potential weapon that we were exposed to, because we have a member of our own government who was using millions of dollars in United States taxpayer money to do research to weaponize a benign virus called coronavirus. And so we have not done the proper research to understand what it is that was making people sick. Because the majority of people who were getting sick from this illness, truly getting sick from this illness, had a blood disorder that caused a poisoning of their red blood cells, making them hypoxic, and then causing damage to the rest of their body as a side effect of hypoxia. That's not a respiratory illness. Dave.
So who do you
That's
think weaponized?
Poisoning of the red blood cells.
So, and who do you think weaponized it?
All I can say is that we know for sure that we have a leader of our own government who was supporting research to weaponize a coronavirus to make it more fatal.
So you think it was created by somebody in the administration? He weaponized the coronavirus to make it more, and for what purpose? Why did he do that?
Well, if you've been reading some of the literature in the world, there seems to be a war going on that most people think is just an infectious illness. But there is a war going on, and there's an attempt to monopolize resources, create what's called the Great Reset, and to change the economies of the world to suit a certain small percentage of elites around the world who want to have as many of the resources in the world as possible. So while you and others are focused on this some infectious disease, there's a war going on amongst the global elites who are trying to fight a very, very strong economic war.
Is it like between us and China, you mean? Like, who would it be between?
Well, I can't tell you all the players, but there seems to be a large involvement with efforts to take down the United States economy, take down the United States government, and to weaken us to create a very different world economy.
So if you were the chief medical, what would you do if you were the chief medical officer?
I'd start exposing the truth let people know that this was not an ordinary virus.
So should I go back to the office, Doc? That's my question.
Again, I think we need to expose people to the truth so they can understand that there's something very different happening in the world today.
So,
and then have people understand that there's a potential that this was not necessarily spread from one person to the other, but that there are other ways in which this illness is occurring. And to actually teach people what they can do, what diets they can do, what supplements they can take, what medications they can take to actually maintain a strong enough immune system so that if they were to get whatever this is, they would easily, resolve their symptoms.
So, Doc, when you say there are other ways to spread the illness, like what would that be?
Well, you had asked me earlier what else did I think this could be. You see, many people are describing this as a flu-like illness, but this is not a flu illness. We're not seeing people develop the classic symptoms of a flu. What we're seeing is that the majority of people are developing dry coughs, a tight chest, and a loss of oxygen in their blood. And that's not because they can't breathe in oxygen. It's because the oxygen that's getting into their body
is not binding to their red blood. And so the red blood cells cannot carry the red oxygen to the body. And so the result of that is very interesting symptoms of blood clots and loss of kidney function, loss of arteries in the extremities, strokes, loss of taste, loss of smell. These are very different symptoms than what you would see in a classic flu-like illness.
So how do you think, how else could it be transmitted if not through the air? Like, what would you see? What do you think?
Well, again, nobody knows exactly what this is. You think that it's being transmitted in the air. We're being told it's being transmitted in the air. You know, now you're supposedly finding it in the anuses of people. So is it something in the food? And if it is in the air, what is it that we're breathing in that's more than just a virus? Is it a poison? Is it a gas? Is it a parasite attached to the coronavirus due to gain-of-function research? Is it the effects of pulsations of electromagnetic radiation that can also create a problem with red blood cells not binding to oxygen?
And that
there's
would
a lot more information here.
And that could be the pulsations of the electronic things in the air could be part of that economic war.
It could be part of what controls the population in fear to think that this is a virus, when in fact there may be other things that are causing the disastrous physiological effects that we're seeing in the body. Now, why is it that you can take two drugs that treat parasites and get people better from this illness, when a parasite and a virus are two very separate organisms, David? And yet people all over the world who have been treated with two medications, very common medications called hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, have been getting better very, very quickly in the beginning stages of the illness, although ivermectin can be used in later stages. And yet nobody's curious as to why this so-called viral illness is getting better when people take drugs to treat parasites. A man who's the medical doctor supporting research to do gain-of-function research on a coronavirus, that indicates that research is being done to weaponize this virus. So you may have a virus as part of what you're breathing in, but that's maybe not what's making people sick. And so nobody's looking to see what it is that's making people really sick. They're thinking that it's a virus, but the virus doesn't behave this way, causing the red blood cells to dislodge with oxygen, causing strokes, causing clotting in the body, causing fluctuations in blood pressure, causing loss of taste and loss of smell, all of which are not classic symptoms of a regular flu-like illness.
Doctor, do you believe it's possible that Bill Gates and his like are behind it?
I don't know Bill Gates. I know that it's very curious as to why all of a sudden a man with no scientific background and no medical background is an authority on COVID-19, on vaccines, and how people should be living or not living.
And do you think, Doctor, that it's possible in this vaccine to be injecting microchips that would allow them to follow us around and see where we're going?
Well, there's certainly been some concern raised by people who have investigated the biotechnology of this injection, who have said that there's a potential for a chemical to be injected in through this thing that they're injecting that could trace us. I don't know, but based on the people who I know have investigated it, I do have questions and concerns about it.
which would go to part of the weaponization and economic control that now they know where we are as well?
Potentially.
Okay. Well, Doctor, thank you very much for your time.
Okay. Thank you.
Joining us from Bnei Brak is Reb Yaakov from the land of Eretz Yisrael. Welcome, Reb Yaakov.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Reb Yaakov, you, I understand, are in the camp. You are against the COVID vaccine, against people taking the COVID vaccine, and we're trying to understand why people would take that position, given the tests done by both Pfizer and Moderna, which showed a very great efficacy to the vaccine?
Well, first of all, I must say that I cannot give advice, especially not over the phone or something like this. That's first of all, I just need to say it. And then sorry for my English. Secondly, there are many risks involved with these vaccines. Unlike what is popular to say in both TVs and radio shows and in other outlets, there are some serious risks involved with this with these vaccines, much greater than with the regular vaccines. So I think, to make it a very summarized answer, the risks involved is the answer.
Yaakov, I understand that, but here's the question. Yeah. There were 1 million people in the Pfizer vaccine test, right?
No. There were about 44.
Well, there's two. There's two phases. There's, now, since they've introduced it, they've had in their first 1 million people, they said there were 7 deaths from anaphylactic shock. Not 9 deaths. 7 of them were people who carried EpiPens, who were people who, you know, if you gave them a measles shot or if you gave them actually a flu shot, would die of anaphylactic shock as well, but nothing to do with the vaccine. There were 2 deaths not related, unrelated, out of 1 million people. And in the Moderna, they didn't give the post thing. There were 28,000 participants. And out of the participants, 19 people got 11 people got sick out of the control group, right? As opposed to 185 not in the control group. And the way they got sick was they had pain at the 11, pain at the injection site, fatigue, headache, acroligia, chills, nausea, vomiting. Nobody had a fatality out of the entire group. So given that data, they list the people who got sick with swelling at the injection site, fever, swelling tenderness, vomiting, chills, but certainly not like we're seeing the deaths that we have now. Like, I believe in Archie Stroll, there are over 4,000 deaths from COVID. So it's true every vaccine or every medical thing has some side effect, but the question is, given that the side effects seem to be so minor compared to the deaths, like, you know, why wouldn't we do that? Like, even if we have a surgery, yes, they still, there's pain from stitching up, and, you know, there's going to be some blood at the wound site, et cetera, but it's understood that the benefit is a lot greater. And why would that be different?
So, first of all, the information you're talking about, 1 million vaccinated people, is not something that you have control over the publication of the results. It's not like the 44,000. And even then, there are many question marks about the fatalities and other issues, like 80 people are removed from the lists and so on. But more precisely, the issue is not with immediate reactions. Most of the issues are not immediate risks. There are many risks that are coming into fruition only months, sometimes years later. And if you examine the way that this test, this ongoing test or trial is conducted, you will see that they did not have the time to exclude many of the very severe risks. This is not a vaccine that is approved by the FDA. There is only an EUA, an emergency use authorization. This means that this vaccine is not approved, and it has many risks that should have been excluded in a real approval process, but were not even examined because of the emergency situation that was declared.
Okay, so let me go through those points, okay? As far as the data in the tests being accurate, Pfizer has a $200 billion market cap. If they monkey around with their test, they would go out of business. I mean, they're in front of the FDA on a constant basis. I find it hard to imagine that they would risk their entire business going under by fooling with the tests. I mean, could you imagine the media backlash, the FDA backlash? It's hard to imagine that. Wouldn't you agree? This is a small part of their business is the COVID vaccine, where they claim they're barely making a profit on it. So, but they have a $200 billion market cap. I mean, fooling around with an FDA report would put them out of business. That's what logic would say, and it would destroy their reputation.
Actually, now, yeah. Their reputation is already ruined in this case, because if you go to the Justice Department, you will see that in 2009, the United States Justice Department announced that the largest healthcare fraud settlement in Italy was given to Pfizer for $2.3 billion settlement. And this includes giving fraudulent information to the authorities.
So can I ask you a question? Why do you think the FDA is supporting them in this endeavor if they believe they're fraudulent?
Well, maybe they think that this time it won't be. Maybe they think that they have...
Okay, so you believe that the Moderna as well as the Pfizer tests have been monkeyed with?
Wait, I did not say that it was monkeyed with in the first place. I said that there are question marks about it. I'm not saying one way or the other. I'm saying there are question marks about it.
Okay. It's a question of to the accuracy of the testing that's submitted to the FDA.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. We recognize if there was something problematic, like they did monkey with it, they would be out of business, both of them, Moderna and Pfizer. Given the amount of public scrutiny, I'm just telling you this as an outsider and an investor in the market, they would go down. Their markets would crash. I mean, that's real. But let's assume, okay. Now,
but wait a second. Yeah. How can you say that if they already have nothing happens?
Because that's not the reputation. What happens is, very often, they submit a test, and it could have been done a little like this, and it could have been a little like that. So they get a smack on the wrist, but it's not about outright. It's not outright monkeying with a test. You know, they're constantly in front of the FDA. It's like every audit finds something wrong, but to say that a material deficiency that allowed millions of people to get a vaccine that is so scrutinized, yes, would put them out of business.
Well, I didn't say that they monkeyed with it the way you are saying. There could be some issues with
it. Okay, that could be.
Yeah.
I agree. There could be issues. There could. But overall, it's these tests are highly relied on. So now you say, so the tests weren't done. You said there are a number of questions you had. By the way, do you have a medical degree?
I'm a professional in statistics.
I'm just asking, do you have a medical degree?
No, I don't have a medical degree. You knew this before I came on.
No, I had no idea. They just told me. So now let's go to the other question. You said that there could be long-term effects. And that's
right.
True. That's true. Nobody could say they can't. But when you have a full-blown epidemic, right, killing thousands of people with the fatality rate, depending on which country you're in, of someplace between 1 and 3%, and they're putting in a virus which is not live, the question then becomes, it's a judgment question. Do we say, let's put in an unlive virus that has been tested, the concept of a not live virus has been tested many times, and 82% of doctors say it's safe? Or do we worry about a davar shelo bo la'olam, something that may be, some new thing that we just don't know about? Like you have some people dying in front of you, and we have a vaccine that has a 94% efficacy rate, or do we worry about something that may or may not happen long in the future? That's the question.
Well, the answer should be that you need to check what kind of information you already have when you're getting this decision. For example, if you know that other vaccines that use the same mechanism, the same antigen, cause mass death in animals, would you still take this kind of vaccine without excluding this phenomenon?
Well, the messenger RNA, there are over 1,000 ways to administer it. And there are times when the membrane that was around it was faulty. There are times the membrane wasn't faulty. So, if you want to start discussing the epidemiology of it, that's great. But it's sort of like saying, we shouldn't eat animals because many people choked on bones. I mean, there are just so many iterative differences in this that, that's why I'm asking. You would need the fact that 82% of physicians and the fact that the heads of Moderna are taking the test and their families are taking the test, wouldn't that be evidence that the medical professionals who understand the antigens and understand the molecules, shouldn't they be the people we rely on?
Well, you're not answering my question.
Okay.
You're going around.
Okay.
I asked, if there is such information, would you still take the risk? Now, about physicians and doctors, most of them do not know about vaccines. If you ask them, you go out and ask them, they don't really know what's in the vaccines. They did not produce vaccines. They did not study virology and so on. So they are not much better than the average person. They do know better than most people, but only by a bit. In this regard, you need to go to the experts.
Right.
Yeah.
So
I'm asking a question.
So wait, I want to go, but I just want to follow up on that. So we agree that we should go to the experts, right?
I'm saying that you need to go to the experts, and if there is even one or two experts that tell you that there is a very serious condition, they are much stronger than even 100 that say that there isn't.
Okay, so now you're bringing up a very interesting point. If you have 100 experts, and 98 say one thing, and two say the other thing,
yeah.
Both halachically and legally, do you go after the rave or do you go after the minority?
If the two say that you have very high chance of dying, you need to go with the two.
Well, the same two would say you have a high chance of dying if you got COVID.
No, they cannot say that because what is the chance that a guy, let's say 40-year-old, will die from COVID from the actual statistics in America?
Well, right now it's between 1% and 3% is the fatality rate. So,
40-year-old?
I don't know. It's across the board for the entire spectrum.
No,
it's between 1% and 3%.
So yeah. So what you're saying is mathematically wrong, even with their information.
Okay.
It's much less than that. So it depends on your age. If you are less than 20, it's much less.
Well, less than 20, it's not. There's absolutely no. But on a national statistic from all of them, it's between 1% and 3% in all the different. In some places in Spain, it's as high as 5%. But yes, it absolutely. Older people are a much more significant risk than younger people.
Yeah, and also if you go to the data of the entire world, you will see that there is no excess mortality in the entire world.
So, I want to go back to your point. You say you accept the opinion of the two experts as opposed to the 98 experts.
Of course you do. If the two say that you have a very high chance of dying and the other 98 say that the alternative is a low risk.
Okay, so let me ask you. Let's say it would be 2 and 1,000. Would you listen to the two?
2 and 1,000?
Yeah. Two say it's dangerous and 1,000 say it's not. Do you listen to the two or the 1,000?
They say that it's very dangerous.
Yeah.
1,000 say it's not.
Yeah. Yeah.
I will ask I will be very interested in the details.
So you would say you could listen to the two?
If they have.
They say it's absolutely. We think it could be incredibly dangerous, and the other 1,000 say it's not. What would you do?
I would ask. What do these two know that the other
it's their opinion. They're virologists.
I'm trying to help you with the answer, okay?
Yeah, okay.
So I would ask the two, what kind of information are you relying on that makes you be so different from the others?
Okay.
And then I would ask these specific questions, the others, and see what answers I come up with. If these questions do not arise from the beginning, then I have no way to decide, because maybe these two know something that the others do not.
So you could, so if you can't, you would say, listen, we have to listen to the two.
If they say that there is a very high chance of dying, 2 against 98, that's halacha.
Well, it isn't. It isn't. It isn't, and it isn't halacha. It's only if the two are bigger bekiyim, if they're bigger experts than the other 98, right? There is machlokes rishayim, and there's an opinion. The Ram's opinion is you listen to the baki. But here we don't know that those two are smarter than the other 98.
You don't need to have them smarter. You just need to have them. They all need to be experts, and you have the, and you have suffix death. You have a probability higher. For dying, and you listen to this doctors that help you avoid death.
So basically, Yaakov, it comes out to that if anywhere in the world there's two doctors who say we think this is dangerous, and there's 10 million doctors the other way, we have to listen to the two, and we say whatever these two think, they think it's absolutely the most dangerous thing. And these two people will say the rest of the world doesn't get vaccinated despite the overwhelming body of medical evidence because we have to be choshish for these two.
So basically now, once again, sure. I think this is a systematic approach in this conversation when you put words in my mouth.
Okay.
I did not say that.
Okay.
Okay, so maybe we should...
I'm saying, what's the difference between 90... Look, you're a statistician, right? 2 versus 98, or versus 2 versus 198, or 2 versus 398, doesn't matter. We're not. It's not the mass of the 98 that matters. It's the 2 that matters statistically. So if am I correct? So if it's 2 versus 98, which is just a number we picked out of the ear, could be 2 versus 198, 198,000. It's the same thing then.
No,
as a statistician...
Yeah, you don't need a statistician for this. It's not the same thing, 2 versus 1 million and 2 versus 100. It's not the same thing. You don't need to be a statistician to understand this difference.
Well, but we have the World Health Organization. We have every major organization in the world saying that we should be taking this vaccine, most certainly if people who are, you know, somewhat at risk. So the question is, do we listen to the experts in all these world organizations, or do we listen to the lone rangers, the few doctors? And look, there are 50 million doctors in the world. There's going to be 200 or 2,000 who always disagree. Do we follow the overwhelming mass of medical journals, organizations, et cetera, or do we listen to the lone rangers? That's the question.
So basically, I told you that... if there is significant risk taking this unapproved vaccine, then the answer should be according to each person with his own calculation and not giving advice to anyone. But in this specific case, this unapproved, and the FDA says this very clearly, that this is not an approved vaccine. You know this, right?
Yes. It's emergency approval.
It's not an approval, it's an authorization.
It's an emergency authorization, correct?
Yes. So they say that it's an authorization, and they say that there is no COVID-19 FDA-approved vaccine.
Right.
Why do they say this?
Because it has not gone through the usual 5-year or 10-year test that vaccines usually go through, because the COVID vaccine is only 10 months old or a year old or a year and 2 months old.
This vaccine, yes, this vaccine, the first date for this vaccine to have any chance of getting validated, approved as a vaccine, is 2023. And there are many trials that need to be conducted until that specific date, and if they will not be successful, it will be either canceled or delayed. So,
Yaakov, it just comes down to, do we listen to the World Health Organizations, plural, or do we just listen to everybody who has an opinion? Do we ask the doctors, do we ask the virologists, or do we just say, hi, it's up to you personally, what do? I'm a carpenter, I'm a baker, I'm a mathematician. Well, do we ask, like, if Dr. Fauci is taking the vaccine, and the President of the United States is taking the vaccine, and the Queen of England is taking the vaccine, and the people at Moderna, do we listen to the people who have the authority, have the expertise, or do we just say, let's listen to the lone rangers of the world? That's really what it boils down to.
First, there are three things to say. The Pfizer CEO didn't say that he's taking it. He said he won't take it. Secondly, the FDA made it very clear that there is a very specific risk But if you learn about it, they could not exclude it, and it's a very, very high risk if you learn about it. That's secondly. And thirdly, if what you said is true, then why do you ask anyone? Just give them this by force, and that's it. Why do you ask them? Why do you care what this guy's brain says and the other guy's brain says? According to what you're saying, you shouldn't ask just anyone for anything. Just go away with the authority, with whichever they say, whatever they say. It doesn't work like this. People should have their own mind and be able to come to conclusion with data. They need to be supplied with data. And if the data is so overwhelming to the side of taking it, people will take it. But if data is not being presented, and even the doctors don't know about this data, then what do you expect?
Yes, I'm saying we do know that, again, that it had a 94.5% efficacy, and even the few people who got it had very mild side effects. And by the way, the CEO of Pfizer said he is going to take it, but he said he won't cut the line. And since he's not 65, it's not his turn yet, but when he can, he would.
Okay, so maybe he will take it later. Right now he's saying he's not going to take it. You want me to go to check the exact quote?
I'll tell you the quote. I have it in front of me. He says he hasn't received his company's COVID vaccine yet, so he will not cut the line. That's the exact quote.
Okay, so he won't cut the line. Cut to the chase, he's not going to take it. Cut the line, I mean, he's the CEO of the manufacturing factory. He can just take one. It's peanuts, you know. It's not cutting the line.
Okay. Well, Yaakov, we thank you very much for your time.
Wait. There is one thing I want to say, please.
Yeah.
The FDA said that enhanced disease, what is usually called ADE, antibody-dependent enhancement, is a potential significant risk. The sponsor identified this risk. The sponsor is Pfizer. And if you learn about this phenomenon, you will see that the animal trials throughout more than 30 years show that it causes mass death in animals. Now, if people will learn about it, maybe they will have a different view. If doctors will learn about it, maybe they will have a different view. Maybe not. Maybe they will consider what you're saying as the absolute truth. But I think that this kind of information needs to be presented, needs to be digested, and needs to be investigated, and people should have the ability to choose freely out of learning and exploring information.
Can I ask you a question? Do you believe that when people go to the doctor, every person who, let's say, has to go through chemotherapy or takes antibiotics should be reading all the possible, side effects of antibiotics, and there's pages of possible side effects of antibiotics, certainly if surgery is. And before we give patients in the hospital any of these things, we should have classes for them explaining to them all the different possibilities and get their opinion before we treat them.
So you're
in the hospitals, we should have maybe auditoriums where people are taking classes, and we should ask the people, given all the possible side risks of antibiotics, should you be taking your erythromycin?
So again, you have this approach of just remove the ability of anyone to judge for himself and just plug it in.
My position is that you're a statistician, right? How would you like if you said, you know what? Here's a statistical analysis I did. Zalman, if you want to do this, you should do your own statistical report. Don't look at me. Well, for that matter, the pilot on the plane, should we ask everybody in the back, what's your opinion? Should I turn left or right? Like, at what point do we trust the professionals, people who've spent 20 or 30 years of their life studying a certain industry?
Again, you're saying that just don't think about it, be blind, and just take whatever. Don't read the details. Don't read all of those lines. It's unimportant. And move on. I have a very different approach. I think that people should be reading and should get educated actions with their lives. If the FDA itself says that this is not an approved vaccine, And consequently, the person who is taking it is being involved in some kind of a trial, human trial. He should know this, and he should understand the risks involved. If you think otherwise, I'm not saying, I'm not going against you, but I think my side is very clear. People should know. People should at least be able to know if they want. Okay?
That's fine. I got that.
Should be available.
Well, Yaakov, thank you very much for your time.
For
all
you,
the best.
For you as well. Thank
Take
you
care. All
much.
The best. Bye, Colter. Bye-bye.